From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle with this week's Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from acc.org. I'm recording this week's podcast on May 6, 2019. In this week's view, I'm going to talk about three articles that were published in the JACC journals this week. One of them is entitled Arrhythmia-Induced Cardiomyopathy. This is a state-of-the-art review and a very important topic. A second article looks at a biomarker, galactin-3, and outcomes after acute myocardial infarction. And the third is a look at the use of diastolic stress test combined with echo and biomarkers to identify patients who have exertional dyspnea as caused by diastolic dysfunction of the LV. All three articles, I think, are very relevant to practice and help us think about our future in care paradigms. So let's start with this wonderful state-of-the-art review by several experts in JACC on the arrhythmia-induced cardiomyopathy topic. Obviously, arrhythmia-induced cardiomyopathy refers to a reversible type of cardiomyopathy, and it includes several distinct types. Today, we're going to talk about tachycardia-induced cardiomyopathy, AF-induced cardiomyopathy, and PVC-induced cardiomyopathy. So let's start with the tachycardia-induced cardiomyopathy. Obviously, this refers to the presence of reversible left ventricular dysfunction solely due to an increase in ventricular rates regardless of the tachycardia origin. Animal models of this show that rapid atrial or ventricular pacing causes structural and electrical remodeling. And when you stop the pacing, there's significant recovery of the LVEF or its normalization. But in animal models, at least, the fibrosis can appear and persist despite the elimination of the tachycardia and apparent normalization of LV function. Actionable knowledge item number one would be that you want to do an ambulatory ECG monitor for at least 2 weeks to try to confirm or exclude this diagnosis. And ironically, of course, the final diagnosis of tachycardia-induced cardiomyopathy can only be confirmed after there's been recovery or improvement of LV systolic function within 1 to 6 months after the elimination of the tachyarrhythmia. When patients have this, in addition to getting rid of the arrhythmia, the treatment should include therapies that we know to work in optimizing medical therapy for systolic dysfunction, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, or ARBs, diuretic agents, and the aldosterone antagonists to promote reverse remodeling. Then let's shift gears to AFib-induced cardiomyopathy. The reasons for cardiomyopathy in AFib could be several. One would be heart rate irregularity that can affect calcium handling. Another would be loss of atrial contraction associated with sympathetic activation contributing to limited ventricular filling and increased filling pressures, or mitral regurgitation and or diastolic dysfunction. Landmark AF trials with antiarrhythmic drugs have failed to demonstrate outcome benefits, including heart failure admissions in patients both with and without heart failure or cardiomyopathy. But this is in contrast to randomized clinical studies comparing AF ablation as a rhythm control versus rate control strategy, in which there's a reported 8 to 18% absolute increase in LVEF in 60 to 70% of patients with AF and cardiomyopathy who were randomized to ablation. The only trial directly comparing rhythm control strategies, that is ablation versus amiodarone in patients with AF and cardiomyopathy, suggested that ablation was superior, improving freedom from AF 70% versus 34%, as well as quality of life, almost halving the heart failure admissions from 57% to 31%. And it looked like mortality benefit also occurred at 2 years, 8 versus 18%. If you're looking at prognostication, the absence of ventricular scar on cardiac MRI or scar burden less than 10% may be a useful predictor of reversibility of AF-related cardiomyopathy. And then this particular paper closes with a discussion of PVC-induced arrhythmia-related cardiomyopathy. PVC-related cardiomyopathy is a diagnosis of exclusion when the burden is greater than 10%, but LV improvement may occur with treatment of PVC burden as low as 6%. Actionable knowledge item number two would be an ambulatory ECG monitor of at least 6 days is recommended for establishment of PVC burden, not just a 24-hour Holter monitor. The cause of contractile dysfunction and PVC-induced cardiomyopathy is not clear, but there may be disorders of calcium-induced calcium release or alteration of L-type calcium channel and the ryanodine receptor. Generally, there's minimal or no fibrosis on histologic examination and on cardiac MR in these patients. Independent predictors of developing this would include male sex, seems to be more common related to symptoms, a duration of palpitations more than 30 months, variability of PVC coupling, interpolated PVCs, tight coupling intervals less than 450 milliseconds, long QRS duration, and an epicardial origin. The optimal approach to treatment would be in patients with frequent PVCs greater than 10% burden, without symptoms or idiopathic VF is unclear, but patients who have high volume PVCs probably should be monitored differently, probably seen every 6 to 12 months, and have perhaps a serial echo and or PVC burden assessment from time to time. There are no randomized trials in this particular space, but retrospective studies show that PVC reduction was greater with radiofrequency ablation than antiarrhythmic drug therapy. Clearly, trials would help us in this space. So it's a quick review of arrhythmia-induced cardiomyopathy, something we see a lot, and I really commend the authors for an excellent and concise state-of-the-art review. So two more quick articles. One of them is looking at galactan 3 levels and outcomes after MI. This is a study looking at galactan 3, which is a marker of myocardial remodeling and fibrosis in over 1,300 patients, mean age 67, who were admitted for their first ever MI. 80% had non-STEMIs. Patients were followed for a mean of 5 years, and they were identified for incident heart failure and death. The follow-up was very careful, including the use of death certificates. Survival analysis was derived, and a risk discrimination looking at the prognostic value of adding galactan 3 to risk prediction models for death, cardiovascular death, heart failure with reduced EF, and heart failure with preserved EF. Results, a third of the patients had elevated galactan 3 compared to reference. This is greater than 22.1 nanograms per ml. The patients who had higher levels were more likely to be women, to be older, and have more comorbidities than those with lower levels. Patients with the highest tertile of galactan 3 seemed to have a higher risk of death, 5 to 7-fold, also cardiovascular death, heart failure, HEF-REF, and HEF-PEF. These estimates, however, were significantly attenuated down when other comorbidities were added in, such as age, sex, Charleston comorbidity index, peak troponin, prior history of heart failure, etc. So the risk discrimination was fairly minimal when galactan 3 was added to the overall model. We can measure that with the C-statistic, which was hardly changed at all by the addition of galactan 3. So the study suggests that in a univariate sense, galactan 3 is strongly associated with outcomes, but that once you put in the model's additional comorbidities, it's hard to show a large effect on risk discrimination with this added biomarker. With all of our biomarkers for both heart failure and coronary risk, we still have this challenge of connecting the biomarker level to better discrimination, to better therapy, and that would be true, I think, also of this study. I think galactan 3 is going to find a home in terms of risk prediction, but exactly where it's going to fit compared to BNP, troponins, et cetera, I think remains to be seen. The last paper I want to briefly talk to you about today is a very interesting paper looking at the comparison of diastolic stress testing with a combined resting echo and biomarker approach to patients with exertional dyspnea. This was a study of 171 patients who had dyspnea, mean age was about 65. They had suspected heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, but their resting peak early diastolic mitral inflow velocity was not particularly outrageous. The investigators looked at echocardiography following maximum exercise, and they wanted to establish whether or not you could actually predict patients who develop diastolic dysfunction with exercise by using mitral inflow patterns and galactan 3 levels. So 171 patients, an abnormal diastolic response to exercise was present in 103, 60%. Independent correlates of an abnormal diastolic response to exercise were the resting E to E prime ratio, the LV untwisting rate, and galactin 3, which we just talked about, a marker of fibrosis. The use of a resting E to E prime of greater than 11.3 and a galactin 3 level of less than 1.17 nanograms per ml to select further diagnostic processing would have allowed exercise testing to be avoided in about 65% of subjects at a cost of misclassification of 13%. The composite outcome of cardiovascular hospitalization or death occurred in about 25%. The predictive value of an abnormal diastolic response to exercise and the combined strategy, resting echo and galactin 3, both showed a similar risk prediction. So because patients who have diastolic heart failure are short of breath, the authors suggested that this might be a two-step algorithm we could use to evaluate this, a resting evaluation of E to E prime greater than 11.3 and an assessment of galactin 3, which would identify patients who maybe should have exercise stress testing and those who maybe should not. So I think this is a very interesting paper. It does suggest that resting E to E prime ratio greater than 11.3 and a blood galactin level less than 1.17 could be useful surrogates for exercise echo in identifying possible HFpEF as a cause for dyspnea. Now, clearly, when you do a study like this, it's a relatively small sample, 170 patients, and it's not hard to actually end up fitting the data for your cohort, and it needs to be independently verified, preferably in a larger population of subjects. If that was true, then this particular stepwise approach to the use of both a biomarker and echo mitral inflow could find value in our evaluations of patients who have dyspnea. So three articles from Jack, different topics, certainly very nice review on the tachycardia-induced cardiomyopathy. I think the galactin 3 biomarker is an interesting one that we're going to continue to learn more about in the coming weeks and months. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. Of course, you can find these articles and their journal scans on the ACC's website. Also, we have a new educational catalog on ACC.org. It's under the Education and Meetings tab. Using that tool, you can get and sort your educational offerings by various formats, and many of these are free. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. I hope you have a great week, and I look forward to talking to you next week on Eagle's Eye View. Thank you.